All right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Shalom Aleichem, Assalamu Aleichem, Namaste, Pak Sat Nam, Sat Sri Akal, Tashi Dalek, Ho Lila Tanyan Wasing Yanke. Oh, I stumbled over that, didn't I? Ho Lila Tanyan Wasi Yake. That's Lakota for hello, may everything be well. And I hope everything is well with you as it is with me. Jeff, go right ahead and report. I'm Jewish. I'm as Jewish as you are, which I don't know if you're Jewish or not, but absolutely, Shabtai Zvi was a Jew. And if you don't know that, you ought to study your history. It is not Christian. It's not Messianic. Absolutely, it's not Messianic. We have nothing to do with those vermin. And this has to do with post-Lurianic, Neo-Sabbatean Kabbalah. It is 100% Jewish. We do not believe in any Messiah named Jesus from Nazareth or Yeshu or whatever those Messianics talk about. We're not Jews for Jesus. No true Jew would convert to Christianity. And so I hope that satisfies you. If it doesn't, then go ahead and report, and whoever wants to inquire can inquire. But we are Jewish, and we have a message that we want to teach, and it is not Messianic. Does that answer your question? Well, okay, fine. Anyway, as I do before each class, I will now recite the Kaddish for the Dead, the Mourners of the Dead. So I ask that you please close your eyes as you listen and remember someone to whom you are close, who has died. And in doing so, you'll honor that person's life and bless his or her memory with the light of your consciousness. Yish Kedov, Yish Kedash Merabo, Bomo divero kirase, viamlek melkase, mekayakon uvyo mekon uvkaye dekol, beis Yisrael, ba'agalo uvizman koryev, ve'imru omein. Yehe shmei rabo mevorak, le'olam ule'ol me omayo, yisbarak ve'yistavak ve'yisparar, ve'yisromam ve'yisnase ve'yishadar, ve'yisale ve'yishalal, shmei dekacho beraku, Le'elo minkol berkaso ve'shoroso, tush bekoso v'nekamoso, da'amirom be'omo ve'imru omen. Yehe shlomo rabo min shemayo, ve'kayim aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael ve'imru omen. Ose shalom bimrumov, hu yashe shalom aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael ve'imru omen. Thank you very much. Now, in our last meeting, I began laying the groundwork to begin teaching on post-Lurianic, Neo-Sabbatean cosmogony and theogony. And what that means is that I began laying the groundwork for teaching on what the great Arizal's views were, followed up by Rabbi Nathan of Gaza's views, were as to how God manifests itself in this world, how God made these worlds, and that would be the cosmology part, and the theogony part would be how God manifests himself, how he goes from being the transcendental Ein Sof, the transcendental, ineffable, unknowable, unnameable God, who exists eternally and unchanging, and goes from that by peeling a part of himself off and a part of his essence, his divine light of emanation, and with that light creates the universes, all of the worlds and all the universes that exist. And then within that universe, filling that universe with, and this world with the life which it has. and then following that up with creating human beings and giving them their avodah, their divine service to perform, their tikkunim, their spiritual repairs, their spiritual rectifications to perform as we work toward making this world fit for the coming of Mashiach, Ben Dovid, and the end of time. Now, I said that I began to lay the foundation for that, and I'm going to, I talked a little bit, yes, Monday, about the absolute necessity of reaching a point in our lives where we begin the process of answering the vital questions of life. I want to talk a little bit more about this subject. And I'll begin by talking about what I'm going to refer to as the game of life. From the perspective of those of us, who are privileged to have been born white, I mean by that Caucasian, and or in the United States, or even if we're not white, who have come to live in the United States, but specifically if you're white and you live in the United States, Canada, or Western Europe, then you can truly be said to be a privileged person on this planet, because far and away the large majority of people in this world are not white and do not live in the United States, Canada, or Western Europe, and most of those people live in a level of economic hardship and deprivation and poverty, and deal with not enough drinking water that's clean, that they can be free from waterborne diseases, and so they live at a standard of living much less fortunate than we do. But so when I talk about the game of life, I'm referring to it from the perspective of those of us who are the privileged few to have been born white, and therefore we're not discriminated against in these countries, these four countries of the United States, Canada, New Zealand, and the continent of the western area of the continent of Europe. And because we're in the majority, we're not discriminated against. And so we don't bear the burden, the many burdens of discrimination that black people in the United States bear, for example, or Latinos in the United States bear. So from the perspective of being white and living in one of these Western European cultures, there is something that I refer to as the game of life. And there are different ways of dealing with that game. When you're born and raised and you become a young adult, then you begin to have to play this game. Now, ordinary people go through their lives wrapped up in their everyday affairs. I'm talking now about work, family, friends, recreation, vacation, acquiring more things, working in our church or our synagogue, working with our congregation, volunteering in various causes, worrying about international politics and economic affairs. These are all of the things that go with a privileged life here in a Western European or American culture. And of course, people who are not privileged don't lead that life. They don't worry about any of those things. They're worrying about whether or not, if you're a young mother, where are you going to get the nutrition to let your breast milk come in so that you can feed your infant, not have to leave it abandoned on a street because you can't bear to see that infant starve to death in your arms because you've already done that before. And many other problems that I won't get into the details of. But anyway, ordinary people approach, in the United States especially, approach their lives wrapped up in these everyday affairs. we got to save enough money to get enough for down payment so that we can qualify with our credit, so we can get a new SUV. I know I already have a car that I drive to work with and a car that my wife drives to work with, but we want to get that new SUV because our other one's 3 years old now and it's going to go off the warranty, and we don't want to have to be at risk from that. And so these are the kinds of things that people worry about. And some people do worry about more things than just their own acquisitions, their own personal problems. They, as I said, they work in their churches or synagogues. They volunteer for various causes, and they are in good faith about approaching life to help people who are not as well off as them. And they even worry about international politics and economic affairs, such as what is the United States doing, invading everybody that it doesn't agree with. Oh, by the way, they have oil. It might have something to do with it, because the United States uses about 70% of the world's, about 50% of the world's oil. But anyway, they worry about these things. And this is called what I call playing the game of life. Okay? But if you go through your life and this is all you ever do, no matter how many times you go to church, how regular you are going to synagogue, no matter how many of the different funds you donate money to help people, you're going to come to the end of your life. Well, you won't even have to come to the end of your life. By the time you get to middle age, you're going to realize that these activities don't produce in you any lasting satisfaction. As time goes by, we become uneasy, feeling an ever-increasing sense of desperation. It's exactly what Thoreau described when he described his fellow men of the time by saying that they, quote, lead lives of quiet desperation. Something is missing from our lives, but we don't know what it is. And that's what leads to quiet desperation and anxiety. That's when people start going, who have enough money, to get counseling, to get psychotherapy. They go find a Jungian psychotherapist and they start telling them their dreams. Why am I unhappy? Other people play the game of life in a different way. These are the people who spend every waking moment, and even the ones when they're asleep, thinking about money, power, fame, and how they're going to get it. How they don't have enough of it, no matter how much they have. How they're going to get more. They'll spend their whole entire lives building corporations, buying and selling corporations, buying and selling real estate. Every living moment of their lives is spent talking to somebody on a cell phone, responding to a beeper, playing golf with people that you want to make deals with, having fellowship in church if you're a Christian, after the services in the fellowship hall, talking with other people about real estate deals. This is what goes on. And it's the same with power. Controlling more and more corporations, more and more businesses, controlling more and more tenements, pressing the people in the tenements for incrementally but constantly higher rents, moving people out who can't afford to pay, getting the mechanisms of our society to enforce your property rights, going for fame. That's what Hollywood's all about. Fame. That's all it's about, a celebrity. Getting your picture in the paper, walking out the door and being surrounded by paparazzi, going to various awards events so that you can be seen, so that people can do interviews with you, so that you can get that next job, either get that next record cut, so that you can meet the right people. All of these things. This is a terrible way to lead one's life. But you know what? None of those people are satisfied. None of those people are truly happy. If they were, they wouldn't go through 5, 6, 7 marriages. And if it's not marriages, then it's just partners. They all have problems. We all have problems. But this is how some people spend their lives. And those activities do not provide lasting satisfaction. You bet it's satisfying when they stand up on that stage and they receive an Emmy for best actor or actress. You bet it's satisfying when they get to lead, go and perform at some event like Farm Aid or some World Hunger Aid or Darfur Aid project and have people think that they're really good people because they go and they perform at this benefit concert. And they are good in doing that. I'm not saying they're not good. But these things only provide momentary satisfaction. It's not lasting. These are examples of playing the game of life. Some people, however, choose not to participate in that game. They choose not to play it. They drop out. What do? They plunge into alcohol or drug use. They become serial sexual participants. They enter into a series of sexual affairs. They go from one woman or one man to the next, always looking for the one that's going to provide them with that satisfaction that lasts longer than the 15 minutes of the act itself. Some of these people enter into high-risk activities. Well, serial sexual affairs is a high risk, and so is alcohol and drug use. So I guess all of these things are high-risk activities. But there are other ones that are really associated with high-risk activities that aren't alcohol, drug use, and sexual affairs. I'm talking about things like big wave surfing, going to that special beach at that special place in the Hawaiian Islands where there's no sand, it's just lava underneath the waves, and it builds up huge waves. It's not Waimea Bay, I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, it makes these waves that are stories tall. People ride them, knowing that if they fall, there's a very good chance that they're going to be pounded and rolled along the bottom and held down by the force of all that water against that lava rock. Maybe knocked unconscious, in which case they'll drown. Or maybe being sucked out by the undertow, in which case they'll drown. Or another activity, high-altitude mountaineering. Now, I'm not talking about the mountaineering that takes place in the state of Washington or the state of Colorado, the Cascades or the Rockies or the Sierra Nevadas in California. None of that's high-altitude. The highest mountains there are 14,000, just a little over 14,000 feet. Most people can deal with that altitude change. I'm talking about things, people who go and start climbing mountains in Alaska, where they're getting up over 20,000 feet, or they go to the Himalayas, go to Pakistan, Nepal, India, China, and there they're climbing over 8,000 meters. That's over almost 25,000 feet and higher, where they have what's called the dead zone, because nothing grows there, not even microbes. Because of the lack of oxygen and ultraviolet radiation that's not filtered by our atmosphere anymore because of the lack of atmosphere. Excuse me. So, this is high-risk activity. Good chance that one mistake is going to be your last mistake. Skydiving, there's another one. Your chute isn't packed right, you die. Something goes haywire, you get caught on that part of the plane coming out, you die. You go up in the plane, the engine fails, you die. Happens all the time. Happened yesterday here in the state of Washington where I'm broadcasting from. 10 skydivers returning to the Yakima area in eastern Washington from some skydiving get-together that they went to earlier. In western Washington, I believe, the plane crashed. Everybody's dead. By White Pass in the Cascades. They're all dead. Nothing to recover but their bodies. So these things happen. It's high-risk behavior activities. Another one, gambling. That's high-risk Because inevitably what happens in gambling is you lose, because the games are designed that you're going to slowly lose. Yes, every once in a while you have a streak of luck and you win. And so you keep on going, but ultimately you lose more than you win, and ultimately you end up in debt, and you end up selling everything that you've got, borrowing all the money you can borrow from people who love you, your friends and relatives, until finally you've cleaned them out, or they just get away from you because they can see that you're like a drowning man who's going to suck them under. In which case it becomes very dangerous, because people to whom you owe gambling debts aren't the kind of people who are willing to wait for your next hit. And so it becomes very dangerous. They might send somebody to tell you to find a way to get the money by tomorrow at 3 p.m., otherwise we're going to break your legs. And if that doesn't work, that'll only buy you two more days, or 1 week, and if that doesn't work, then we'll have to teach a lesson to anyone else who gets behind on his debts, on his gambling debts, and then you'll end up being a body in an alley. So all of this behavior is undertaken by people who choose not to play the game of life. They drop out and they plunge down this slippery slope into darkness. But this type of behavior is a part of one's search for satisfaction. Why do people do this? Scientific research has shown that these types of activities release in the human brain endorphins and adrenaline and other neurotransmitters, all of which trigger receptors in the brain that cause the brain to experience intense feelings of well-being and pleasure. In other words, these people are searching for a way to feel happiness and satisfaction and pleasure. And it works. It works. But the feeling doesn't last. As soon as it fades away, you've got to return to the well and drink more deeply. You always have to keep going back. And because the brain, because these are addictive behaviors, there's a type of tolerance that develops. And so it takes a little bit more endorphins, a little bit more adrenaline, to turn those neurotransmitters on and make them produce that feeling of happiness, pleasure, well-being, satisfaction. So you got to take more drugs. You have to drink more alcohol. You have to keep engaging in sexual affairs. You have to move from just regular sexual affairs to more offbeat sexual affairs and activities, more dangerous activities. You got to push the envelope a little further when you're big wave surfing or climbing in high altitude mountains. Instead of skydiving, you migrate to base jumping, jumping from the top of cliffs. You don't even use an airplane anymore. You go and you jump off a cliff. You jump off of a tower, a radio tower. You go to the top of a building and climb over the fence and jump off. Now you get arrested if you survive. And if that isn't enough, I know people who have gone to the edge of the Black Canyon of the Gunnison River in Colorado and have jumped into this narrow ravine that's thousands of feet deep that has a rushing torrent at the bottom with no place to land except boulders on the sides to see if they would survive. And they did. But this is the type of high-risk activity. And you always have to push the envelope, increase the odds. Why? Because of the tolerance that the brain builds up. Because your feeling of well-being, satisfaction, and pleasure is artificially induced through physical means induced by brought on by activities that you're doing. So you always have to drink more deeply from the dark well. Well, the truth of the matter is that whether you play the game of life or you drop out of the game of life, you're never going to find this feeling of lasting satisfaction, of wholeness, of completion that we all crave. It's only going to come about when we acknowledge and confront the great questions of life. What are these questions? Well, a character in a Kurt Vonnegut novel, and I can't remember right now the title of the novel. I'm sure somebody out there is going to know this when I mention it. But there's this character who, by a quirk in fate, an accident, acquires immortality. He can never die. I don't know, he might be killed or something, but by accident, but he can't die. He's not going to age and die. And for a while he plays around, several lifetimes. But after a while, he experiences the same thing as I've been talking about. He doesn't have any satisfaction in life. A deep sense of ennui prevails upon him. He becomes bored. And so he decides that he has to do something, to spend eternity doing something. And he finally figures out that what that is to answer the question, the universal question of life. And he puts it in these words: why are we born only to suffer and die? Why are we born only to suffer and die? So he spends the whole rest of the novel traveling all over the universe, through different galaxies to different planets, following up on leads that he's heard about. Some civilization here came up with an answer, or some civilization there. And always the answer is something totally ridiculous or meaningless. But anyway, this question, why are we born only to suffer and die? That is the question of life, isn't it? Those are as good a words as any. But let's make this a little bit more specific. I talked about this a little bit in our last meeting. But here's the questions that we're really concerned with. These are the questions that really matter. Not whether we're going to stay in Iraq or bring the troops home, and whether or not whatever we do is going to make the world a more dangerous place, or whether Iran's going to get a nuclear weapon and then there's going to be a nuclear holocaust. Those questions, they don't really mean anything, because there's nothing individually that you and I can do about those things. There's no use worrying about those things. Those things come about as a result of the collective destiny of man, the collective karma of man. What's going to happen there is already happening in the collective unconscious. And nothing that you or I say or do about it is going to change it. We have a realm, a sphere of influence that's around us as we walk through this life. And it's only within that sphere that we can have any impact. But you know what? That's all right. God said, that's all I expect from you. Have an influence on the sphere of influence. Have an effect on the sphere of influence that I've given to each of you. Some is a little larger, some is a little smaller, but we all have one. Here are the questions that specifically we need to ask. Who am I? Who am I? Where did I come from? How did I get here? Why do I exist? What is the purpose of my existence? Does life have any purpose? Or is it all just random events? Sound and fury, as Bill Shakespeare said, signifying nothing. Where is God? Why does God never show his face to me? Why don't I hear his voice? Some people say they hear God. Why don't I hear God? Are they just schizophrenic? Why did my daughter have to die so tragically and so young? Why couldn't it have been me instead, so that she could feel the grief that I feel instead of me feeling the grief over her passing? Why is there so much evil and pain and suffering in the world? Why has humankind, why has our species learned so little of love and compassion and brotherhood in the thousands or millions of years that we've existed on this planet as human beings? How can we be still slaughtering each other in ever increasing numbers and ever more lethal and efficient ways? What's wrong with us? Until you begin to ask these types of questions, you have not embarked upon the spiritual path, the spiritual journey. And you will not be satisfied because your life will not have any valid purpose to it. Now, the spiritual path, where does it go? It leads to God. I don't care if you call it Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, Catholicism, Protestantism, Baptism, whatever, Baha'ism, or Baha'i, whatever they call it. It doesn't matter. Each one of those is a spiritual path, and all paths lead to God, the source from which everything came, the source from which we came. God alone is truth. That's a saying. That's one of the sayings by which I open every session. I say, let me find it here. I say, where is that here? Sat Sri Akal. That's Punjabi, the language of the Sikh scriptures. Sat Sri Akal. God alone is truth. God alone is truth. And all paths lead to God. We came from God, and all paths lead back to God. Okay? And it doesn't matter which one of those paths that you get on, because all of those differ only in dogma and creed, which are details with which God does not concern himself. God alone is truth. God is the sole source, moreover, of purpose and meaning. The sole source of purpose and meaning. This is why no matter what else you do, you can only get a brief taste of satisfaction and happiness. Because God only gives a little bit of it to you there so that you'll stay restless. So that you'll start looking for the source of that happiness. And what does that happiness and satisfaction come from? It comes from a sense of purpose and meaning to one's life. Now, God wants us to come back to Him, and He wants us to establish a partnership with Him. Or I'll put it in biblical terms. He wants to establish a personal covenant with you and with me, with all of us. God wants a personal covenant with us. And what are the terms of that covenant? Well, the terms are this. He will say to us, I want you to do my will in your world. God wants us to do his will in this world of forms and names, this world of physicality, this world of space and matter and time, materiality, temporality. And in return, God will give us His holy light. And in that holy light, our lives acquire purpose and meaning. The kind of purpose and meaning that doesn't wither or fade away. Why does God need us? Because He has no physical form in this world. No eyes to see. No ears to hear. No mouth to speak. No arms and hands and legs and feet with which to do. Or I could say that in reverse. I could say that we are God's physical form in this world. Because we are. That's what it tells us in Bereshit. That God made us in His image. In His form and likeness. He made us. Male and female, He made us. God is androgynous. God is beyond Now, this is the immanent God that I'm talking about now. When I say that God made us and God is androgynous, this is the immanent God. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Blessed Holy One. This is the God of Israel. This is Tiferet Yisrael, the beauty of Israel that I'm talking about. We have been made by Him in His image. I say His. I should more properly say its, but it just sounds so strange to everybody. We are His eyes, His ears, His mouth, His arms, and His legs. If we don't do... God is a spirit, see? God is totally spiritual, except for that part of God that's within us. That's our soul. And He needs to connect with our soul. And we need to put our egos in harness to His will. We need to make a covenant with God and say, all right, God, do with us. We will be your eyes, ears, mouth, arms, and legs. Do with us whatever you will in this world. We shall be your Evadim Hashem, the servants of God. If we don't do God's will in this world, it just won't get done. Now do you begin to see a possible answer to the questions that I just a few minutes ago asked about? When I asked the question, why? I said, why is there so much evil and pain and suffering in the world? Why have we learned so little of love and brotherhood in the thousands or millions of years that human beings have existed on this planet? Because if we don't do God's will in this world, it doesn't get done. That's why there's so much pain and suffering. Not enough of us are doing God's will. We came from God, as in God is our root. God is our source. Yes, God made us. He had the thought, and then He spoke, and His will was done. And here we are. And we must embark and continue on whatever spiritual path we choose that leads us back to God. The path that I choose is that of Judaic mysticism, Native American mysticism, because I have both of those in my blood. Both of those I have descendants from both of those traditions, I have ancestors from both of those traditions. And so I've inherited, and I firmly believe that all religion is organic. You can't just go adopt something. It adopts you. It's in your blood when you're born. So now we have lots of Christians among the Gentiles. We have lots of Hindus among the Indians and lots of Muslims among the Persians and Arabs and Pakistanis and lots of Confucians and Taoists among the Chinese, because that's what they're born into and their ancestors practice those religions. And so there's a genetic memory there. Okay? But it's to God whom we must return. And we embark upon a spiritual path that we have either chosen or has chosen us, as I just said, that takes us back to God. Or maybe put in a better way, the path that brings God back into our lives. You see, not contrary, because it's true that God banished, Yahweh banished Adam and Eve from Gan Eden when they sinned. But there's a Kabbalistic teaching that says that it was Adam who banished God from Gan Eden, not the other way around. And what is the meaning of that teaching? The meaning of that is that man hardened his heart, put a big, ugly, hardened shell around his heart, and banished God from the lower Eden, which is this world and the heart of each human being. Because that's the natural home of God. And just look around and you'll see it. We live in a secular a secular humanistic society in the United States. Lots of people believe in God. Lots of people believe in religion. But God has basically been banned from so many aspects of our lives. We've driven God out of our lives to a large extent. We think about God, if we're Christian, on Sunday morning in church for about 1 hour. That's it. Some of us might pray a little bit more if you're Jewish. You know, maybe you go a couple of times a week. Maybe you go to the Friday service and the Erev Shabbat and Shabbat services. But that's about it for most people. We have banished God from our lives, not the other way around. We are called upon to circumcise our hearts so that God can come into us. What I mean by that is to remove the evil foreskin, the husk, the shell, from our hearts. What is that foreskin? It's the human ego. It's the part of us that says, I want, I need, I must have, I must do, I must control. It's the gross ego, as referred to in by some of the Eastern masters of Hinduism and Buddhism, the gross ego, as opposed to the more subtle ego. It's the unripe ego, as referred to by Sri Ramakrishna, the founder of Vedanta. It's that part of us that dominates all of our waking thoughts. It's the ego that controls our minds, our decisions and actions. It's the ego that thinks it's in charge. I just get a kick out of, before I used to plan, I went to business school, got an MBA. I was in business for 30-some years, mostly for myself, and other times I held various management positions for other companies. And I was a strategic planner, a tactical planner, an implementer. Every day I had on my desk, before we had computers, I had on paper with lists, I had post-its, and I had, when we got computers, then I went to Outlook and I had little reminder bells that go off and everything I had to do so I wouldn't forget. And that's the ego. The ego thinks that if it makes lists, that's the list maker. The ego's the list maker. It thinks if it makes lists that it's going to actually have an impact in the world, that it's going to get something done, that what it does is going to matter. The ego is that part of us that thinks that it shapes our destiny, as I just said. The ego is that part of us that wants to live forever. The ego is our body. Okay? It's the psychological, psycho-spiritual controller of our body. It is the body. It's the body it's the mind of the body. It wants to live forever. And moreover, it's the part of us that believes it is God. So we have to circumcise our hearts by removing the foreskin that is our ego. We have to remove that ego. We have to get it out of control of ourselves. We have to tell it, as I did one morning. I remember being on the patio back of my house when I lived in Medford, Oregon, and thinking about my life, and it just suddenly, like a flash of light, went off in my mind. And I realized that every decision I had made had brought me to the sad state of affairs. I had lost my business. I had lost my home. I had lost two of my three cars. That's right, I had three cars. I had a pickup, a nice brand new pickup, a vehicle for going climbing, a BMW for going to work, and a nice Oldsmobile for my wife. She didn't like driving the stick. the BMW, and I loved zipping around in the BMW, and it made me feel big and important when I go to those business meetings. But all of it came to nothing. Why? Because collective destiny of human beings, being what it was, decreed that there was going to be something called the dot-com bust. And then right immediately following that was going to be something called 9/11. And immediately following that was going to be a recession in which we would go from several trillion dollars in surplus to several trillion dollars in deficit as a nation. And I'm here to tell you that that destroyed a lot of businesses. Well, my business was one of them. 10 years of work, 7 days a week, around the clock. 10 years of success was destroyed in a little under a year. It was all taken away. I felt like Job. But this one day, God answered my questions as to why, God, is this all happening to me? And there was this flash in my mind, and what it was essentially this thought. Oh my God, it's been me. It's not God who's done this to me. It's me. God gave me everything I asked for. God fulfilled all of my dreams. He let me choose my path. And the path I chose was one to believe in the material things in this world. To believe in the necessity of acquiring a business, of building a business up from scratch, and of playing the game of business, which is a subset of the game of life that I've been talking about earlier, and becoming a successful businessman. And I'd already been successful in ventures earlier in my life and had those crash too, because business is nothing but a series of cycles. And that's the way it will always be. But it's my decisions. It's my ego being in charge and saying, I want to have a nice house. I want to have a nice BMW, a nice car. And I owned these things. Didn't own these things. I owned all these things. I wasn't in debt. That came later when I tried to save the business. When I sold my house that I'd owned for 34 years and put the money into the business, thinking that the economy was going to turn around, that I could outlast my competitors who were better financed than me and who did, many of them did die, their businesses left before mine did. But anyway, it was my ego. I was driven by my ego to do all of these things. And I realized my ego hasn't made good decisions. My ego can't be in charge anymore. And on that day, at that moment right there, I literally fired my ego. I said, you're finished, buddy. You have screwed everything up in my life. You are incompetent. It's obvious that you haven't got a clue as to what you're doing, or I wouldn't be in this position. You're done. You can't make any more decisions. And it was an epiphany. It was literally the light going off. And I had instantly this huge sense of burden being taken from my shoulders. And I said right then, from now on, I'm not going to work for other people to make them wealthy, and I'm not going to work for myself to make me wealthy. From now on, I'm going to try to find out what God wants, and I'm going to do what God wants in this world so that I can make this world a better place than it was when I came into it, so that I don't get to the end of my life and find out from an angel or from the accuser before God, HaSatan, the adversary, and in Hebrew, that I wasted my life in pursuit of material things, which mean nothing. And I wasted the soul that God put into my body and God's time by not doing His will. And so ever since, I have let God be in charge of my life. And that's what we have to do. We have to circumcise our hearts. That means remove the ego, fire the ego, get the ego out of control. Put God in charge. Enter into a partnership with God. Say, God, I'm your servant. I beg you to tell me what you want me to do with my life. You direct me each and every day. Each and every day you tell me what to do. And that's what I'm going to do. And I don't care what the downside of it is. I don't care if I lose my home. I don't care if I lose all material things. I don't care if I get a disease. I don't care if I'm killed on the street by being stabbed by some schizophrenic person who thinks I'm the devil or thinks that Jesus told him to stab me. I don't care what happens. Because whatever happens from here on out is going to be the fate that you have reserved for me before I was born. And from here on out, I'm going to do your will. This is what we each have to do. If we want to have happiness and satisfaction in our lives, there is no other way. Period. That, my friends, is what Gurdjieff describes as the terror of it all. In other words, we have to give up control of our lives, hand them over utterly to God. We have to surrender ourselves. That's what the word Islam means, by the way, for the Muslims out there. Islam, surrender to God. We have to surrender our lives, our physical bodies, our minds to God. This is what it means. When we're commanded, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, the circumcised heart, with all thy soul, that's the part of us that's divine, that's God himself that's in us, and with all our might. We have to surrender to God, let God put God in charge, and do what God wants. And then and only then will we experience satisfaction, wholeness, completion. Well, that concludes today's lesson. In our next class, today I talked about purpose. In our next class, I'm going to begin to talk about identity. Okay? Identity. And you can kind of see where it's going from today. Our identity is not something that's individual to us and alone. It's collective. And I'll be talking about that. Talking about identity in our next meeting. So, until our next meeting, this lecture will be rebroadcast tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific time. And so if you want to listen to it again, you can come there. Or it's also going to be saved as an MP3 file and posted to our website at www.universal-sabbatean-church.org. So you can go there at any time and listen to it again. Until our next meeting, which will be on Monday at the same time and place here. And I ask that you remember God at least twice each day. And I hope that you will go from strength to strength. God bless you all. Zagizant.